Welcome to the Kate Languages podcast. I'm your host, Kate Clifton. I'm a former MFL teacher who left the classroom in 2017 to set off on my own adventure. Since then, I've developed my passion for helping teachers through creating time-saving teaching resources, delivering language lessons and CPD to languages teachers, and of course, through this podcast. I've had some wonderful feedback from teachers about how my work is helping them with their everyday teaching, and I love connecting with teachers from all over the world. To get in touch, you can find me on Instagram and Facebook. I'm at Kate Languages on both, or you can email me through my website, katelanguages.co.uk. But for now, grab a cuppa, although maybe not if you're listening in the car. Sit back, relax, and enjoy another episode of the Kate Languages podcast. Hi, how are you? Welcome back to the Kate Languages podcast. This is the final episode in season 8 of the podcast, and it is not as advertised a coaching episode. Well, it's a Q&A episode, so it's coaching after a fashion. The irony of the fact that last week's episode was about my biggest failures, and I have spectacularly failed to get somebody to come and join me for a coaching call, even for free, which is, yeah, I don't know. September, I think, is a very busy time for people. And yeah, perhaps people just don't have the mental bandwidth at the moment. But if you want a free coaching call and you're happy for it to be recorded for this podcast, do get in touch and we can record one ready for next season. This is something I still really, really want to do. It's just not quite happened for this season, but I have so many questions, so many amazing questions from my Instagram followers. I basically just put a plea out over the weekend. So I'm actually recording this just a week before it goes out. So just to give you a bit of behind the scenes of the Kate Languages podcast, I usually record podcast episodes a few weeks before they go out, so that they're all ready and waiting and scheduled. And I like to be well organized. And actually, this is going to be one of the questions I'm going to answer. I like to be very well organized and have things very planned. I am half German. Don't know if that if that has an impact. But yeah, so I normally do like record them quite far in advance. But for, yeah, so this one, it is actually already October and I'm just recording it a few days before it actually goes out. So I put a call out over the weekend. I was like, please, can somebody ask me a question? And I got so many really, really good questions. I think, to be perfectly honest with you, a lot of these questions could be a whole episode in and of themselves. So what I'm going to try and do is answer the questions quite briefly. Although if you've ever listened to my Q&A episodes, don't know how good I am answering questions briefly, but I'm going to try to answer the questions briefly. And then actually, if these are things that you would like me to go into more detail about, do get in touch. The best place to get in touch with me is either through Facebook or Instagram, or email hello@katelanguages.co.uk. And just let me know, like, which of these questions have really resonated with you and what would you like me to go into more depth. If you really want me to go into a lot of detail, I'm really happy to do workshops and things like that on, like, some of these questions I genuinely think could be easily be a 1 hour workshop. And like I say, a whole podcast episode and things like that as well. So let me know. And if you've got any questions for next season, which will start in January 2025, which at the moment feels like a really long way away, it will come round before you know it. I will start season 9 with a Q&A episode. Do you know what? This is actually working out quite well because season 2 didn't have a Q&A episode. So every season so far, the season 8 Q&A episode was Q&A episode 7, and it's just become really, really confusing. So this is Q&A episode 8. So when I start season 9, it will be Q&A episode 9. So finally, the Q&A session will actually align with the season numbers. Anyway, I mean, that's just admin, isn't it? But yes, so to follow on from last week's episode, I have spectacularly failed to do a coaching episode. However, what I have learned from it is Q&A episodes are great and, you know, every cloud. Right, I'm going to jump right in to some of these questions because, like I say, there are loads of them. So I've screenshotted and printed them all off from my Instagram. So Here we go. All right. I've actually combined a few questions into like different categories. So my first category, I thought I'd start with some really positive stuff. So the three questions I'm going to answer that I feel are kind of all quite similar is, number one, for a PGCE student, what is the best part of MFL teaching from your experience? Another question that I think is related to this is, where do you see MFL teaching in 20 years? I think this is a positive one. I hope so. And then another question was, what inspires you about languages? So like I said, I just wanted to think about the good things and the positive things. So the best part of MFL teaching for me, I do know it's quite funny because it's the bit that I don't get anymore, and it's working with children, working with young people. There's a feeling when you've been in a school for a couple of years as well, when you've been there for a while, if you take on a class in year seven and they've never done languages before, I used to find this particularly with German because they don't ever tend to do German at primary school, that you know that by the time, you know, when they're getting through year seven and into year eight and into year nine, pretty much anything they can do in that language is because you've taught it to them. Occasionally, yes, you get students who are really keen and they go off and try and learn some stuff by themselves, but that is extremely rare. But also a great thing about teaching, if you've actually inspired a student to, you know, want to learn a bit more on their own, or if you've inspired them. And again, especially with German, because I just think people, like, they don't tend to go to Germany. But if a kid comes to you and says, I've persuaded, or, you know, sometimes at parents' evening, the parents would say, oh, yeah, they've been nagging us to go to Germany. Like, you know, they really, really want to go to Germany so they can practice their German. And things like that is just such a great feeling. And I think quite often, and I've got a whole section about motivating reluctant learners in this episode as well, quite often people, British people in particular, sorry, you know, I'm British, but we are quite negative about languages. Let's just put that out there. British people can be very negative about languages. And I think to be able to inspire kids and to make them realise that learning a language is just a nice thing to do. And I think I've said this quite a few times before, and I think to me this is one of the most important things, and this answers what inspires me about languages as well, is the mindset shift of realising that just because something is different doesn't mean that it's bad or wrong. So people say things in a different way, or in other languages they have different grammatical genders, for example. It doesn't make it bad. It doesn't mean it's wrong. It's just different. And I think particularly in today's world where people are very polarized and people are like, my way of looking at the world is correct and your way of looking at the world is wrong, that actually giving students the opportunity to understand that people can speak differently to you, people can look different to you, people can be, you know, different, whatever, religions, speak different languages, all those kinds of things, I think is very wrapped up in languages teaching. And I think that is why, even after Brexit, even when, you know, motivation isn't necessarily high, is why I still believe that students should learn languages. I still think it's a really, really important thing for people to do. It doesn't matter if they're going to be fluent languages. I mean, you know, most people are not going to learn languages to a fluent standard. It's just not going to happen. But I think having that mindset shift and that appreciation that languages, yeah, just that things can be different and that people come from different countries. And if you ever are lucky enough to travel to France or Germany or Spain or Italy or wherever, you know, even further afield, I mean, my husband and I went to Morocco and we could communicate with people in French in Morocco, and it's just amazing. It's just such a wonderful thing to be able to do. So yeah, I mean, honestly, I could just rant on for ages about how wonderful languages are. The other question in this little section was, where do you see MFL teaching in 20 years? And I think, again, I see it very much the same as it is today. Obviously, AI will play a role. And, you know, I had a really great conversation with Joe Dale about that for the second episode of this season. And yes, AI is obviously going to become a huge part of our lives in the next 20 years. I mean, crikey, I trained 20 years ago and life is unrecognizable. And, you know, life is changing rapidly So who knows? Who knows what's going to be around in 20 years' time that doesn't exist now? But at the end of the day, people are still going to travel to other countries and they are still going to communicate with people in other languages. So yes, you will have technology to help you. You'll have things on your phone. I mean, you already do, don't you, where you can say something in, you know, whatever your language is, and then it will translate it for you. But nothing beats going to a country and actually having a conversation with somebody and being able to communicate with human beings. And I do wonder as well whether, obviously during the pandemic, everything was very much online and on Zoom and things like that. And I feel like people are wanting to go back to doing stuff more face-to-face and just having that human connection as well. So I don't know, in 20 years' time, life could be very different, but I don't think you're ever going to remove that need and that want for humans to actually communicate with each other. So there you go. So some really nice things to start with. The next kind of few questions I've got are more to do with leadership in languages departments. So I've got three questions on this. The first one is, how can you ensure you're a good head of department? The second question is, what should a second in MFL department do? And the third question, I think, is still very much related to leadership, is about implementing changes. They've written, implementing changes, department agree, but then they just carry on same old with usual practice. So to start with how to ensure you're a good head of department, I know the person who sent this question is quite a new head of department and she's quite a new teacher as well. She's very experienced in, you know, she's not like 22, but she retrained as an MFL teacher, I would say at a later age. I think she's still younger than me. I do know her quite well, which is why I know all this background. And I did the same. If you listen to my failures episode from last week, I became second in department in my third year of teaching. And it's not unheard of, and especially in the current climate, I think it's quite normal for people to move into management positions quite early on in their career. And it's quite, yeah, it's hard. I think being a good head of department, you need to think about the kind of leader that you want to be. I do think it is worth spending some time like reading books or listening to podcasts or, you know, trying to think about being a leader and the type of leader that you want to be. You know, are you going to tell your department, this is the way we do it, you've all got to do it exactly the same as me? Or are you going to give them more autonomy? Perhaps, especially if you're a newer teacher and they've been doing it for longer, are you going to say, I totally respect the way that you teach, I am going to kind of monitor how everything's going, but at the end of the day, you can teach in the way that you want to teach? Or are you going to have a more, you know, like I say, a more cohesive approach where everybody pretty much does the same thing? And that also relates to resources. Like, are you sharing resources? Is everybody just kind of planning their own lessons and getting on with it on their own? Or are you actually taking time together as a department to share resources, to share ideas and things like that? And that relates to meetings as well. So departmental meetings, you know, don't waffle on for hours and hours and hours. I think it's really, really important to have really clear, concise meetings. I mean, I am a waffler. I'm aware of this. If you've listened to the podcast, I'm a waffler. But I still just think, you know, you need a clear agenda and people need to feel that they can contribute. I think they need to feel that you are approachable. And one of the key things is you don't have to pretend that you know it all and that you know all the answers. And that, you know, like I say, I wouldn't go in there going, right, this is how we're doing it, I'm right, everything else is wrong. And I tackle my workshops and things like that very much the same. It's like, these are my ideas, this is what I think, and I'm totally aware that other people feel differently. If you've got research and evidence to show like why you want to implement these changes, if you do them in your own class first and they can come and observe you doing them in your class and they can see that it has a positive impact, then I think they're going to be much more likely to be on board. I think it's very, very difficult to change people's behaviour, which is why, again, being aware of different leadership styles and reading. So an example that just pops into my mind is Brené Brown's book, Daring to Lead. which is on my list. I haven't actually read yet. So my team is expanding quite a lot. I've got 4 tutors now and I've got 2 virtual assistants. And I'm becoming a lot more aware of the fact that, you know, I do need to think of myself as a leader in my business and that, you know, I need to think about how I'm leading and how I'm delegating and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I think the implementing changes one is really hard, but lead by example. So show them what you're doing, show them how it's effective, give them the chance, like even say, and we're going to get somebody to cover a lesson. You don't have to use your precious freeze, get someone to cover a lesson so you can pop into my lesson for half an hour. You know, do that around the department so that you're all helping each other and that they can then watch what you're doing. And say, this is the thing that I want to do. So I don't know, if you're wanting to implement a phonics focus every lesson or every other lesson or whatever, say, right, I'm going to be doing it within the first 20 minutes of the lesson. Come to my lesson for 20 minutes. Just watch how I'm doing it and think about how you can incorporate that into your lesson. And just remember that behavior change takes a long time, that people aren't just going to go, yeah, that's great, and then be able to do it straight away. So it will need some help and some support and some practice. The other thing to remember, especially for teachers who've been doing it for a long time, is that you quite often, especially in September, you come back and, sorry, SLT, but SLT in particular will say, oh yeah, right, now everybody's going to do this same starter activity for the whole, like for every lesson across every single subject. And particularly MFL teachers will look at that and go, no, because it just doesn't fit with what we're teaching, or, you know, things like that. And I think, and I have experienced it so many times in schools where SLT will come up with, you know, say, right, you all need to do this. And then 2 weeks later, they've forgotten, or it's just not happening. So I think sometimes if there is something that you really, really, really want to implement and you really, truly believe that it's really important, you need to focus on just that one thing. And it needs to be consistent, and you need to give them the time and the support and the resources and stuff to actually implement that thing, but don't try and do more than one thing at a time. So the other question for this section, again, about leadership, what should a second in MFL department do? This is actually a really difficult one. It's quite interesting. I had a job interview once for a second in MFL, and the reason they didn't give me the job is they said that a lot of my answers were more for what a head of department would be doing. And I thought, oh, maybe I should be applying to be a head of department rather than second in department. My experience at a second in department ended up, again, listen to my failures episode from last week, ended up with my head of department basically separating us into, she was French, I was German. And I just kind of, it was just me and one other German teacher. And I just kind of like ran the German bit on my own. So I didn't have a particularly positive experience of being a second in department. Or head of subject as well. It's, you know, it's a difficult one to do. I think of it as, put yourself in the position of a vice president. I know recently, so this is October 2024, we don't know the results of the American election just yet, but when Kamala Harris was choosing her running mate, who is Tim Walz, do you know what? It's so funny, in a couple of years, like, you might have completely forgotten these names, or they might be president and vice president, who knows? Anyway, when Kamala Harris chose Tim Walz, a few people were quite surprised, and they said there were other people who they thought would be better, or, you know, people who are very ambitious, who they thought might, you know, she might have chosen instead. And I listened to a really interesting podcast. I can't remember which one it was. It might have been Americast, or it might have been The Rest Is Politics, one of those ones that argued that actually, as a vice president, you need someone who's not going to kind of show up the president, or who's not going to want the limelight for themselves. And I think a second in department now, when I look back, I think that's what you need to be, a second in department. You're in a supporting role. You do need to sort of sit in the shadow of the head of department a little bit. You don't want to show them up. Maybe it's more like an admin-y role. So in your departmental meetings, for example, you can be the one who's taking the notes and you're distributing the notes to your department and things like that. I think personally, every member of the department should have a strategic role when it comes to, you know, planning your curriculum and things like that, and planning resources and sharing resources, all that kind of stuff. The second in MFL could be somebody who, you know, kind of collates all that kind of stuff and just make sure that people aren't duplicating. I think what's really, really important is that you talk to your head of department. So as I say, I had a really negative experience at one of my schools in London a second in the department, because I literally could not speak to my head of department because she just didn't talk to me. She just hated me. I don't know why they employed me, because I felt like she never liked me from the beginning. But yeah, if you can have a good relationship with them, and then obviously if they're sick or if they're away for any reason, then you will step in, you know, for staff meetings, whole staff meetings and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, I think you do have to be aware of, like, as a second in department, that you are not the head of department. The head of department, you need to kind of respect the decisions that they make and that kind of thing. And it's hard because, again, I know the person who asked me this question and I'm pretty sure she's been head of department before. So I think it's quite hard to take that step back. But also just think you don't have that responsibility of head of department anymore. So that can be a really positive thing as well. Okay, right. I've got through 2 out of 7 sections here. So I've already been talking for over 20 minutes, so we'll see how we get on. The next 3 questions are business related. And I just want to say really quickly, if you are interested in more of this sort of business and marketing content and things like that, DM me close friends on Instagram and I'll add you to my close friends list. Once a week, I basically share some content about business and marketing, mindset, all that kind of stuff, which I absolutely love. And I will be doing another podcast episode next season that's more related to all that kind of stuff, because I know that for a lot of people who are thinking about leaving teaching or setting up a side hustle or anything like that, people are really enjoying that kind of content. But okay, my questions on the more sort of businessy side of things are: your email about having passive income as a teacher, how can you get started? And it's very much related to how can I get more followers on my Teachers Pay Teachers page, which is another question. And then, do you wish you had left teaching / started your own business sooner? No, it was the right time for me. And it was a good time in terms of setting up an online business and things like that. I think if I'd left, I think it's a good time now as well to be leaving. But no, I think I'm quite a believer in everything happens at the right time for the right reasons. And so that was the right reason for me. And also I have the confidence of knowing that I've taught for like 8, 9, 10 years. I kind of lose track before I actually left. And I feel like I, you know, kind of did enough that I've got the confidence, you know, that I can answer questions about being head of department or second department or those types of things with more confidence now because I did it for longer. So no, I don't wish I'd left teaching or started my own business sooner. Passive income, how can you get started? My advice for this, and also about getting more followers on your Teachers Pay Teachers, or that's a bit more American, whereas we in the UK would have Times Education Supplement, TES, if you don't know what TES actually stands for. So TES Resources in the UK. My advice for both of these is to do stuff for free, basically. So getting passive income, that sounds ridiculous, isn't it? It's like, well, if I'm doing stuff for free, how am I going to get any income from it? You need to give stuff away for free so that people know how good you are. And with Teachers Pay Teachers or TES, you need to give stuff away for free. You need to give away free samples. I mean, even now, okay, when I look at my numbers, I've got over 1,500 people who've signed up to my free resources. I do not have anywhere near that number. You know, I've got like 50, 60, 80, I can't remember how many it is altogether because it's 3 different languages for my yearly subscriptions. All right. So that's a massive discrepancy in numbers. But those 1,500 people are using my resources. They're looking at my free resources. And if and when they have the budget, if they're looking for more resources, they will think of me because they've already got my free resources. So it's really, really important to do stuff for free. And when that comes to passive income, what you want to be doing is doing stuff for free to figure out what you want to do. So do you like making resources? If you put stuff on TES or Teachers Pay Teachers for free and still nobody's downloading them, then maybe you're not doing the stuff that people actually want. If you sign up to do, so for example, in November, I am speaking, I think this is my 3rd time now, at the Language Show. I get the Language Show and Language World muddled up. So Language Show is online. It's a virtual event in November. I'm speaking on the Sunday afternoon about phonics. And it was one of the first things I did. I think it was in the pandemic. And it was one of the first kind of like workshop things that I did and realized, oh, I actually really enjoy doing this. You don't get paid for it, but it's great exposure for people to know your name. And again, actually, for the person who asked me about the Teachers Pay Teachers, getting your name out there through conferences and online workshops and, you know, webinars and all that kind of thing, I think is a great way of increasing your following. So yeah, just do stuff. It doesn't matter if you're getting paid for it, because you need to just get yourself out there and get your name out there and realize what you actually want to do. Okay, so whether it's actually creating resources or whether it's doing workshops or webinars or things like that. But yeah, so that's my main advice for those. Okay, right. The next section is, I love this. It's all about planning. So this is great. Firstly, how do you balance being a mum and a business owner? And secondly, how do you manage your to-do list? I'm struggling to find an effective method. So, yes, I love a to-do list. My to-do list is actually, it's my day split up into usually around half hour segments. And I write pretty much every single day. And I have shared this on social media before, like my list, like literally. Okay, I will read you for today. Hold on a second. So for today, today's a Monday. I've even on my to-do list, I've even put which uniform my son needs, because he has three different uniforms. He has normal uniform, forest school uniform, and PE uniform that he wears on different days. So I've even put that at the top. Then I've got 6 a.m. alarm, read Michelle. I'm reading, finally, trying to finish Michelle Obama's autobiography and have a cup of tea at that point. 7 a.m., get G up. 7:50 a.m., leave for name of George's school that I'm not going to, obviously not going to share on my podcast. 8:45 a.m., walk at a place where I stop on the way home from dropping him off. 9:30 a.m., emails and money stuff, which I do every Monday morning. 10 a.m., more kind of business planning, stuff like that. 10:30 a.m., mop bathroom floors. 11 a.m., podcast, look at questions and record. That is what I'm doing right now. It is currently 10 to 12, so I've given myself an hour to do this. Probably won't be ready for 12 p.m., lunch. I've even put what I'm going to have for my lunch, some minestrone soup, if you're interested, and then so on and so forth. I do that every day. And even though my alarm goes off at 6 a.m. every day, I write it on my to-do list. 6 a.m. alarm. So Tuesday, I've already planned out for tomorrow. 6 a.m. alarm, read tea. 7 a.m. get G up. 7:50 a.m. leave for school. 9 a.m., which is when I'm hoping to be back, emails and checking some questionnaire for my dictations workshop, which is happening in 1 week's time from when I'm recording this, which is the day that this podcast comes out, if you want to get your last minute tickets. So yeah, so that is how I manage my to-do list. I literally plan every single thing. And then to balance being a mum and business owner, it's a lot easier now that George is at school, although I'm finding my sense of urgency has diminished somewhat, because when he was at preschool 3 days a week, I literally only had, so like I said, almost, you know, my days, I'm starting work about 9:30. By the time I get back, yeah, I feel like 9 a.m. checking emails tomorrow is probably a little bit ambitious. So I tend to start work about 9:30. And then I tend to leave at, do you know what? Today and tomorrow, I don't actually have to leave to pick him up, which is amazing. My husband and then my mum are picking up. Anyway, but I tend to leave at about sort of 2:30. I have to log off, right? So that's 9:30, 10:30, 11:30. It's 5 hours. So I was doing 5 hours, 3 days a week. So 15 hours. Being able to run a business in 15 hours a week is quite amazing. I did also, you know, do some stuff in the evenings and weekends a little bit, but generally 15 hours. I've gained an extra 10 hours a week, which is great. So I was saying I've kind of lost my sense of urgency a bit, but I have to plan my days like that. And when he's home, so he'll be home by at about 4:00 this afternoon. Yes, it's a really long way to my son's school. We are slightly mad. He's at the school 25-30 minutes drive away. Anyway, I have in capital letters on my to-do list, family time. And the time between picking him up from school and him going to bed, and then, you know, evenings, I quite like to spend time with my husband as well, is our family time. And that's how I plan it all in. And I really try, this is one of the hardest things I find. I try to put my phone to one side. I try to just, you know, focus on him. Even if we're just like sitting watching TV because we're a bit tired, having our tea, we all eat tea together at 5:00-ish, depending on when I can get it ready for. Having his bedtime, all that kind of stuff. You know, we really try to be really present with him at that time in the evening. My husband works from home quite a lot, so he's around as well. And then even when he commutes to London once or twice a week, they're really good. He usually manages to leave about 4:30, gets on the train at 5:12 and is usually home for bedtime, which is absolutely amazing. We're obviously very, very lucky with that situation. So yeah, so that's how I manage my to-do list and balancing being a mum and business owner. I do need to just say I am tired. I'm always tired. So that's something that I think I've just had to just to put up with, which is a horrible thing to say. But yeah, I hope this is all really helpful for people. And I hope these answers are really, really good. I've got lots and lots of questions about motivating students, reluctant learners, and behaviour and all that kind of thing. I think what I'm going to do, I'm going to read out all the questions. I'm going to give you a couple of ideas, but I'm going to make a note of these. And I think this would be a really, really good episode for next season. So I'm really sorry. I'm not going to answer these questions for another few months in depth, but there are so many of them. And I have been visiting schools a bit more recently. And I've definitely noticed from, 8 years ago when I left the classroom to today, I don't know if it's a post-pandemic thing. I don't know what it is, but I'm noticing behaviour is different, particularly year sevens, which is confusing because year sevens always used to be very cute and small and scared and well behaved. So yeah, the year sevens coming in, and I think there are a lot more SEN issues and things like that, that, you know, children just need a lot more support these days. So I do think this will be a really good full episode. So I'm going to read all the questions. I think these questions are going to resonate with a lot of listeners. So do let me know if these questions resonate with you, and if you have any really good ideas, that would be amazing. All right. First question was, what's the best way to get a class comfortable with one another? That's for year 10. Another question is about motivating / teaching students to revise when it feels like we're competing with important, in inverted commas, subjects. Another question, how do you motivate an extremely quiet class of year 10 French students? I can't get anything. It's interesting that year 10s are a bit sort of shy and quiet, and yeah, I don't know. It's an interesting one. Another question, how do you motivate very, very low ability students? I have a handful who are struggling, grades 3 and below, and trying to motivate them to get a pass is proving very difficult. Another question, what's the best way to support GCSE kids that are always absent? And again, this has changed, I think, a lot since I was in the classroom in 2016. Absenteeism, yeah, definitely. Real problem with absences. And the last one for this section is, how do we support very SEND in mixed ability with no support in classroom and behaviour is bad? I mean, that's just a perfect storm, isn't it? Sorry. It's very difficult. And I think the first question, the best way to get a class comfortable with one another, is actually the key. The problem is, I want to say something that people are going to say, but we're not allowed to do that. We have to crack straight on with the curriculum. Spending time at the beginning of a class, helping students to feel comfortable with each other and to get to know each other, in my opinion, is as or even more important than the actual learning of a language. I don't know if that might be a bit controversial. I don't know. I'm not saying you don't teach them anything, but teaching them how to learn and teaching them how to interact in a class together is so, so, so important. So one of the things that I've got that I have shared with my free resources, it's not there anymore because it was only for September, but you know, if you really, really need it, I can shove it back up there again, is some find someone who activities. Okay, so in the first lesson, you actually helping them get to know each other a little bit, and that you're doing activities with them where they are starting to like just learn things about each other. You know, it might seem like a bit of a cliche walking around the class saying, oh, have you ever been to, this is in English, by the way, this is not in the target language. So, you know, have you ever been to Paris? And they're like, no, obviously not. And then you say, yeah, no, me neither. Would you like to go? Yeah, I love Emily in Paris. Oh yeah, me too. I mean, I don't know if teenagers watch Emily in Paris, but whatever. They're getting to know each other. I mean, I remember being at school. Like, this is really awful. I'm really sorry if anybody I went to school with listens to this. They probably don't. I didn't really like most of the people I went to school with. I didn't want to be friends with them. I didn't really care. But I think it would be nice for teachers to try to help their students to actually communicate with each other, interact with each other. And something else that I think is quite controversial. I am not a massive fan of seating plans. What I quite like is letting students sit wherever they want. Then you know who they want to sit with. And if they work well with the person that they choose to sit with, that's fine. They can stay with that person. If they're a bad influence on each other and disrupting each other and the rest of the class, then you know who to move them away from. So there you go, a bit of a sneaky one there about seating plans. But yeah, but that's another thing as well. So I've mentioned this before on the podcast that I'm very introverted. And I think people probably find that a bit weird because I come across as quite confident. But I hate talking to people I don't know. I just feel so awkward. Like, I really hate phoning anybody. I always make my husband make phone calls for us. So if you put yourself in the shoes of a slightly shy 14-year-old who has been sat next to a boy that they really don't like, or, you know, they just don't know very well, and they're like, I don't want to speak to this person, I'm scared, then yeah, you need to put yourself in their shoes and just think, like, oh, they'd rather sit with their friend. And if they feel comfortable sitting, and especially year 10s, you know, if they're comfortable sitting with their friends and it helps them to work, then I genuinely don't see a problem with that at all. Yeah, so I think to motivate a quiet class, and I think a lot of this is also about, it does help to motivate lower ability students to get them to, you know, supporting mixed ability and things like that. It's actually getting them to feel comfortable with each other to start with. Motivating lower ability students, in my experience, is all just, it's all about helping them to feel like they can succeed and that it isn't completely impossible. Going back to basics, doing single words, not bombarding them with big long sentences and texts and things like that, you know, looking at single words, playing fun games to practice them. Fun games, by the way, doesn't necessarily have to involve them calling things out for the in front of the whole class. You know, they can work together in pairs. They can do puzzles. They can do crossword puzzles, things like that. You know, that can be quite fun for some people. I find it quite fun, that kind of thing. And I think at the end of the day, you can't force them to like languages. Again, that could be a very controversial thing people don't want to hear. But to go back to the thing I was saying right at the beginning about just having an idea that languages is a nice thing, that's great. You might be able to inspire quite a few students that way, but there will always be students who hate languages. They hate foreigners. I'm sorry to put it bluntly. There are a lot of people who come from homes where they are so rude about anything foreign. The parents feel quite, what's the word I'm trying to think of? The parents can feel quite threatened when their children are learning a foreign language and they know words and they can say things that they can't understand. Like, as languages teachers, we probably forget this. But if your child can, and especially if you've got like two siblings who are both learning French and they try to talk to each other in French and the parents don't understand, that can be quite threatening for a parent. So then they're not going to give them the support that they need. You know, it's all these background things that we need to remember. And at the end of the day, you are not going to motivate every single student in your class. And they might have stuff going on at home that you just can't even imagine. So for them, their French lesson, if it's a place where they literally just sit quietly and just don't get in trouble and they just but don't do any work, then at least they feel safe. I don't know. The problem is that you then get the pressure from SLT and they get the pressure from, you know, governors or the trust or whatever, and they get the pressure from DfE and, you know, the pressure is piled on in so many different places. And it is hard. It is really, really, really hard. So as I say, I'm going to leave those questions there. But I think this is something I would like to maybe go into more depth and talk about in more detail at a later date. So yeah, so hopefully the little bit that I've just said there is helpful for you, and then look forward to a more detailed episode about that in future. But be aware that I'm probably a little bit idealistic and maybe a bit controversial. If you are interested in positive behaviour and stuff like that, I have got an episode that I did with Erica Sanchez about positive behaviour management. And also in season one, I did one about the Danish way of parenting as kind of classroom management. So I think it was like classroom management Danish style. And there's some really, really good ideas in there as well. So do listen to those ones. Okay, I've got a couple of curriculum design questions here. Again, I feel like this could be a whole episode, so I will give a brief answer to these. And yeah, maybe go into these in a bit more depth in other episodes. Okay, so where would you start when planning a French and Spanish curriculum from scratch? That's a massive question. And how to map vocab, phonics, retrieval, etc. precisely across a curriculum in the minimal time we have. My main answer, like where you start here is start at the end. I always say this. Again, I do have an episode called Designing a Curriculum where I talk about this in a bit more depth. But start from the end. What do you want them to do at the end? If you're designing a Key Stage 3 curriculum, what do they need to be able to do at the end of Key Stage 3? Obviously, with Key Stage 4 curriculum, you know, what do they need to do to be able to pass their GCSE exams? If you are in a school system where they're not doing exams, there will still be something that you are aiming for. So what do you want them to be able to do at the end of the period of time that your curriculum runs, basically? And the vocab, phonics, retrieval, all that kind of stuff, then you kind of like work backwards from there. So if you're thinking about retrieval practice, you introduce something, you want to practice it a week or two. It depends how many lessons you have. So if you've got three lessons a fortnight, introduce something, practice it again a fortnight later, then leave a bigger space. So maybe a month after that, and then again, maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 months after that, you know, depending on the school year and when it all fits in with holidays, all that kind of thing. But you want to be coming back to stuff at least every few months, especially like the really, really important things. One thing I think is really, really important in languages as well is that you are, I don't know, we're talking about like adjectival endings. You're introducing them in one topic and practicing them a bit with that topic. And then you show them in another topic. This thing that you learn when it comes to hair color can also be applied to talking about school uniform. So you're introducing something and then you're repeating it at a later date in a different topic. Because I think one of the problems that we can often find with students is that they don't seem to realize that they can transfer something they've learned from one topic to another topic. So that's really, really important. The same when it comes to phonics. So I always recommend that you do one sound symbol correspondence. So one sound a week, or again, potentially one sound a fortnight, depending on how many lessons you have and what your timetable is. And then the following week, you can revise that sound plus add another sound. And then the week after that, I would leave. So say we've got sounds 1, 2, and 3. So I would do 1 for a week or two, 1 and 2. So introduce 2, practice 1 for a week or two after that. The following week, introduce sound number 3, practice sound number 2. The week after that, you want to be practicing sound number 3, introducing sound number 4, revising sound number 1. The week after that, you might be doing sound number 5, practicing sound number 2, revising sound number 4. And a lot of that depends on which vocab you're doing and how it kind of all fits in with what you've done. But my biggest piece of advice is that these things need to be planned in. They can't be an afterthought because it will never happen. I mean, like talking about my to-do list, like if I don't write down the times that I'm going to do something, it doesn't happen. I just forget to do it. There's a couple of things at the bottom of my to-do list for today that I might end up like forgetting about because I haven't actually planned them in time-wise. So yeah, so plan in exactly when you're doing them. And if you're a head of department, to go back to another question about how do you ensure that people implement them, that's the type of thing you need to say, right, we need to be doing this. And this is a priority with phonics in particular. I would say partly because phonics is not necessarily something that people have been doing for years and years and years. So that needs to be more at the forefront of your mind now, you know, for it to then become embedded and then just become part of your normal routine. But again, yeah, listen to my Designing a Curriculum episode. I think that's probably a really good one for that. Right, the last couple of questions I want to answer, again, I think these are kind of related to these ones I've just been talking about, but also, again, could be a whole episode in and of themselves. What are your best tips for scaffolding in teaching / MFL resources? And then another question, when do you remove sentence builders so pupils work independently? So my quick answer to that is I don't know because I don't use sentence builders. I've not used them, but I've used, you know, vocab booklets and support. And I would say as you are teaching, I feel that students should have as much support. And this relates to the scaffolding question. I feel like students have as much support as they need. Like you don't need to take the support and the help away until they're really, you know, until they're doing tests, really. But as I say, I don't use that sentence builder methodology. So I'm not sure. That might be a question for somebody else who actually knows that kind of, you know, more clearly. But my thoughts are that you give them all the vocabulary, you practice the vocabulary, they have it written in front of them when they're doing their speaking practice, when they're doing their writing practice. Potentially, if you want to be doing a listening, I do have quite a lot of questions about listening, by the way, but I am going to do a separate episode on those just to let you know if you ask me questions about listening, because there's a lot of those. But yeah, so maybe if you're doing reading or listening and you don't want them to be accessing the sentence builders or vocab lists or whatever, my answer to a lot of questions is always, it depends on your class. It depends on their level. It depends on, you know, there might be some students in your class who need that scaffolding, who literally aren't going to be able to create stuff spontaneously on their own for a long time. But there might be students who are like, no, I'm going to put that to one side and I'm going to come up with my own thing. Personally, I think they need the frameworks and the scaffolding for most of the time in lessons. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. I mean, when I'm writing resources, I don't sit there and just like write it all off the top of my head. I use online dictionaries. I use a lot of AI now to help me, and then I can, you know, tweak it and change it. I use a translation function in PowerPoint and Microsoft Word. I'm not embarrassed to admit this because it's saving me a hell of a lot of time. So yeah, so I don't think it's a bad thing for them to have access to the help and the scaffolding. My best tips for scaffolding in general for teaching and MFL resources are that you position everything for, you know, the kind of the top end with a bit of an extension above to push and challenge some learners. For the scaffolding, I would always say things like writing frames are absolutely fantastic. My exploit in one text method really, really scaffolds everything, because you're basically introducing what you want them to produce. So you're giving them the text, you're giving them the vocabulary first, then you're giving them the text and they're working with the text, really understanding the text, translating it, etc. And then you're giving them a task for them to produce some language, and they can use the vocabulary and the sentences. They can use the text that you've given them as their writing frame, and they can just change a few words, or they can just put it to one side and completely rewrite it. That's up to them. But that's how I feel like you should be scaffolding things. Not, and I've talked about this in my stretch and challenge episode and my stretch and challenge workshop as well, it's not about creating different things for different students. Not at all. And there are some things like dictations, for example, it's quite easy to scaffold because you can give them the gap fill, or you can literally just give them the transcript and they just have to put it in the right order and things like that. So that level of scaffolding, I think, is not too difficult in MFL. I don't know what it's like in other subjects. Okay, right. That's the end of all the questions that I wanted to talk about in a bit more depth. As I said, there's a few questions about listening, and I think I'm going to do a whole episode on those. And there's a couple of quick questions. Somebody's asked, I'm thinking of teaching in the UAE. Is there many people that you've heard moved and regret it? No, is my quick answer. I personally wouldn't want to live in UAE because I couldn't live anywhere hot anymore. But no, I have not really heard of people moving to other countries and teaching in international schools and massively regretting it at all. So go for it if that's what you want to do. But there are other places as well. I loved living in Indonesia, for example. Another question is about the IGCSEs. This is somebody who has made the move. I'm pretty sure, from what I remember, she does actually live in UAE. So maybe I need to get these two people in touch with each other. She's asked me about IGCSE. So Q5 strategies and IGCSE. My answer to this is I don't know. I don't have any strategies for this because I don't really know about the IGCSE. However, this is very much on my list for resources that I want to develop. I'm kind of working through a lot of new GCSE resources at the moment. But yeah, I do want to learn more about the IGCSE. So bear with me for that one. So yeah. And I know that my audience is becoming a bit more international, and I do know that there are a lot of people who are doing IGCSE, and people have been asking me about this for years. So I'm sorry. Another question was about how do you find funding to uplevel your language? I know that the person who asked me this is Scottish, so I don't know if these things are available, but things like Cervantes, the Institut Français, Goethe Institute, things like that, they might have some funding, or there might be things that they offer for free. The other tip I would give you is that you'll be very surprised to find a lot of schools have secret CPD budgets. They're not like totally secret, but there's sometimes a pot of money, quite often a pot of money, put to one side for CPD that I think people don't access as much as they could. My other tip is if you are being asked to teach a language that you don't speak, particularly if you've literally, like if you weren't employed to teach that language. So one of the people I tutor at the moment was employed to teach French and German. I don't know if they ever had German, but they've definitely phased that out. Like she's not teaching any German anymore. She teaches French and she was just told, yeah, you've got to teach Spanish. And we're just phasing in Spanish now. And she's like, but I don't speak Spanish. So she has gone through her union. She's got 3 years worth of lessons with me. So I teach her every single week. And we're in year three now. And the union have made sure that her frees are protected when she has her lessons with me. So secret CPD budgets, ask a union. If it's for your own interest, then probably you're not going to be able to get your union involved. But if it's something that you're basically being told to do, then yeah, get your union involved for sure. Okay, right. I think, oh no, there's some questions about A-level. Again, I feel like that's a question for another episode. Somebody's asked what I think about the new GCSE. I've done a few episodes on that, so you can have a little listen back to those. And yeah, some primary. Okay, yeah, there are a couple of questions about primary as well. So can primary MFL teaching have a consistent impact on GCSE outcomes? Is it a realistic aim? And what was the other? What's the number one thing that's helpful for year sevens to come into secondary knowing? Okay, so I'm going to leave you with a bit of a teaser. I am hoping to speak to Dylan and Hayden, who are from Teach Sleep Repeat podcast. I went onto their podcast and we were talking a little bit about languages in primary school. So do go back. I don't know when that was, somewhere, sometime last academic year. I don't know, like summer 2024. So yeah, so I spoke to them on their podcast about languages in primary school and also a bit about running an education business. And I'm going to get them onto the podcast. So we need to set it up. So I know they listen to this sometimes. So Dylan and Hayden, we need to get this set up. We need to get a date set up to record. And I'm going to get some really good questions for you about languages in primary school. So they're not language specialists. They're not MFL specialists. But I do think it's really interesting for secondary colleagues to get that perspective from like what life is like in primary schools, particularly when it comes to languages as well. So I'll have some answers to that as well then. So that's going to be hopefully next season, and that'll be out in January 2025. So there we go. That is season 8 of the Kate Languages podcast done and dusted. 2 Q&A episodes, lots and lots of stuff about AI, quite a lot of stuff about running a business and what a failure I am. And yeah, I hope you've enjoyed the season. So like I say, I'll be back with season 9 in January 2025. I'll be answering more questions from lovely, lovely people like yourselves for the first episode of season 9. Get in touch at any time with questions. I will try to keep a list of them. Get in touch through social media or email hello@katelanguages.co.uk. Have a great rest of this term. Have a great Christmas, because I'm not going to be back before Christmas. And yeah, I will see you then. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Kate Languages podcast. If you did, please think about leaving me a 5-star review. And you can also tag me on social media to let me know you've been listening and let me know your thoughts on the episode. Also, don't forget to subscribe so the next episode of the Kate Languages podcast can be delivered straight to your device as soon as it's released. But until then, auf Wiedersehen, au revoir, adios, bye.